This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Medrash says on the Posuk Ki HaMitzvah Hazos, this mitzvah, Omer Rabbi Levi b'shem Rabbi Chama bar Chanina. Rabbi Levi says in the name of Rabbi Chama bar Chanina, Kol mi shematchil b'mitzvah ve'eino goimro, anybody who begins a mitzvah, begins a process, a sequence of events, which all constitute a part of a mitzvah, ve'eino goimro, but he doesn't finish it. And somebody else comes and finishes it. Nikreis al shmoi shegomra. The mitzvah is attributed to the one who finished it, not to the one who started it. That's a difficult chazal and in some ways a little unfair. A person can conceive of the mitzvah, a person can have the initial motivation to do the mitzvah. A person can prepare all that has to go in, all the ingredients that has to go into constituting the mitzvah. He can begin the actual process and do it, and he gets just until the end, and somebody else comes and puts the finishing touch to it. And it's the second person who gets credit for it. That's not really fair. The example the Medrash gives, Ketzad, for example, Moshe hitchil b'mitzvah shenotol atzmoisov shel Yosef imo. You remember when Yosef was dying, he requested of his children to bury him, his family, to bury him in Eretz Israel when they leave Egypt. When the time came to leave Egypt, everybody was very busy. It was quite a dramatic sort of time when everybody had a lot going on, and they left in quite a rush, as you'll remember. And who was it who remembered to dig up poor old Yosef? It was Moshe. Moshe, who had the responsibility not only for himself, but he had the responsibility for 2 million other people, and he had to get them all out of there fast. He was the one who remembered about Yosef. He went to the cemetery, he took a shovel, and there was Moshe Rabbeinu himself with a shovel in his hand in the middle of the night, digging up the grave of Yosef, taking the coffin, lifting it out of the grave, and carrying it with him. As it says, Vayikach Moshe es atzmus Yosef imo. Moshe himself took the bones, took the remains of Yosef with him. Nobody else, he didn't delegate it, he did it himself, it was his mitzvah. And he took these bones and he made sure that the coffin was with him all the time, and they crossed the Red Sea with it, and they went through the desert all these years and years and years with the remains of Yosef. Vayudeshele hichnison le'eretz Yisrael. But he didn't bring them into Eretz Yisrael, because Moshe never went to Eretz Yisrael. Nikreis al Shimon shel Yisrael shekavru oisom. The mitzvah is referred to on the name of Yisrael, because they buried him. Shenemar, as it says, Ves atzmos Yosef asher heilu b'nei Yisrael mimitzrayim kovru b'shem. In the book of Yoshua it says, and the remains of Yosef that the children of Israel brought up with them from Egypt, they buried in Shechem. Asher he'ela Moshe mimitzrayim en ksiv kan. It doesn't say the remains that Moshe brought from Egypt. He was the one who remembered. He was the one who worked. He was the one who struggled. He was the one who took the responsibility. And when it comes to giving credit, the credit goes to the Bnei Yisrael because they did the burial. There seems to be a very special status for the one who finishes the job. Much more so than for one who starts the job. And that's very difficult to understand. Surely it's the one who starts it that should get the credit. Surely he sets the motion in process, the process in motion. Surely he's the person who motivates, who creates. Surely he's the one, it's due to his efforts that the whole thing becomes a reality. So he didn't finish it off. So there's a little detail at the end that due to circumstances, not because Moshe didn't want to, it's not because Moshe forgot. Moshe simply didn't have the opportunity to finish the mitzvah because he wasn't allowed to go into Eretz Israel. So what's the big deal? He didn't finish it off. Is that a reason in the credits not to give him the credit, to give somebody else the credit? And so we see that there are two very different roles in the fulfillment of a mitzvah. the initiator is one part of it, and the one who finishes it off is the other part. Let us understand firstly a little bit more about why finishing it off is so important. There are really two different values to an action. There is the practical side of the action, the results. The results are very important. If an action achieves no results, then the whole validity of the action must be brought into question. What was its purpose if it didn't achieve any results? And yet, even in the process, there is some value as well. And there's some actions where most of the value is in the results, and there's some actions where most of the value is in the process. So for example, if you have a business plan that you formulate, and it's designed to achieve certain things and to achieve certain profits, and you conceive of the plan, and you begin to initiate the plan, and you begin to implement the plan, but you never get to finishing it, so you don't get anything out of it. It just costs you a lot of money and it doesn't make any money. What is the value of that plan? It has no value at all. But if you decided you want to finish all the works of Shakespeare, and you started reading the first plays, and you read the second play, and the third play, you finished halfway through, and then you got tired of it, you can't say, well, it's no value at all. You didn't finish the job, you set yourself a task, you didn't finish it, it has no value at all. It's not so. Sometimes the process has a certain value, which may be enhanced by completion, and sometimes the results have the primary value. And the process is partially important. But even the process is affected by the results and by the end of the process. And an example that I use to explain that is, imagine a person who's used to, who's been training for a long time, so he's used to running 20 kilometers. And he's been running 20 kilometers a day for years and years. It's really nothing for him. He does it very, very easily. And then he decides he wants to really push himself. He wants to really get his pulse up, and he really wants to tone himself much finer, and he wants to break some records, and he wants to be able to improve his distances. He can't start on kilometer number 21. He's got to do the 20 kilometers before he can start really pushing himself. He's got to go through all those 20 kilometers to get to that extra kilometer that's really going to make the difference. So it's the last kilometer that makes the difference. But it was the 20 kilometers that needed to be run in order to get him to that difference. There was nothing he could do until he got there. And so it is in many, many areas. Imagine a painter who's painting a portrait. The portrait has to be completed. Until it's completed, it has no value. But it can't be completed unless all the preliminaries are done right until that last stroke of paint that he puts on it. So the last stroke of paint is in itself not that important, but without that last stroke of paint, everything else up until then is meaningless. And so we need to understand, when a person performs a mitzvah, that there are two parts to the mitzvah. There is the effect the mitzvah is having on him, and there is the mitzvah in itself, its own parameters, and the fact that it's a task, it's a set of cause and effects and results. It's something which is able to attain completeness, and it's something that needs to be completed. There's a particular mitzvah that we're going to look at this evening, and that's a mitzvah that's going to affect us a little bit later this evening. The question of teshuvah, of repentance, and particularly of vidui. Vidui forms a central theme in the slichos, both in these days, from now until Yom Kippur, and again on Yom Kippur itself. Vidui is the confession process. What is its function, what does it do, and what is its relationship to the rest of the teshuva process? We would think that vidui is the beginning of everything. You've got to first acknowledge you've done wrong before you can start doing teshuva, before you can start repenting. So surely the first thing is an acknowledgement of having done wrong, which is a confession. I did such and such, and I ought not to have done it. And then we come onto the next stage, which is regret. I'm sorry I did it. If you're not sorry, there can't be a teshuva. There can't be a teshuva. So I did it is number one. I'm sorry I did it is number two. and I'll never do it again is number three. Those are the obvious stages in the process of teshuvah. But the Kiryas Sefer on the Rambam says the following: Hatshuvah v'havidui mitzvah echod hi. Teshuvah, repentance, and vidui are one mitzvah. She'ein vidui b'li teshuvah, because you can't have a confession without teshuvah. So whereas we thought that vidui is what sets it all in motion, the first thing is to confess and then you do teshuvah, says the Kiryas Sefer, no, you cannot have vidui without teshuvah. Because if one confesses, but you haven't decided never to do it again, that's the example the Gemara brings and the Rambam brings it. In the days of the Beis HaMikdash, if you touched certain dead reptiles, you became tomei and you couldn't go into the Beis HaMikdash. There were certain restrictions that applied, and you had to go into a mikveh in order to cleanse yourself. And the example that is given is Atovel v'asheretz b'yodo. The fellow goes into the mikveh, hanging onto the sheretz, hanging onto the reptile, and he comes out again and he says, now I'm cleansed. We say, but you haven't let go of the reptile. The cleansing process can't work as long as you're holding on to it. So it is a person who does vidui and hasn't let go of the sin is like going into the mikveh, clinging onto the reptile. Which means that the way the Kiryas Sefer is learning the Rambam is that the process of vidui is the equivalent of going into the mikveh. It's the cleansing process, which we'll come back to in a moment. V'havidui, and here he says an interesting thing, V'havidui hu gemara teshuvah. Confession is the final stage of teshuvah. Everything else comes first, and the last thing is confession. Which means we're going to have to redefine confession a little bit. This term of vidui, we're going to have to redefine, because that doesn't make sense. Surely the first thing is you confess, you acknowledge, and then everything else flows out of that. No, he says, the confession, the vidui, is the very last stage of the whole thing. The Rambam seems to go this way too, because the Rambam words it in a strange way. Kol mitzvah is shebatoira. All the mitzvahs in the Torah, bein asei, bein lois asei, whether it's a positive mitzvah or a negative mitzvah, an act of commission or omission, im ovar odom alachas mehen, if a person transgressed any one of them, bein bezodon, bein bishagogo, whether he did it deliberately or he did it by mistake, kesheyase teshuvah, when he does teshuvah, veyoshuv mechetoi, and returns from his sin, then he's got to do a vidui, he's got to do a confession. And the Rambam goes on to say that there are several cases where doing tshuva is not sufficient. You have to bring sacrifices in the days that we had the Beis HaMikdash. So if you had to bring a korban chatos or an oshom, two types of sacrifices, the korban chatos or the korban ashom, then bringing them alone is not sufficient. Just bringing the sacrifice is not going to bring atonement. Ad shiyasu teshuva v'yisvadu vidu dvorim. Two further conditions need to be present. Teshuva, you need to do repentance, and there needs to be vidu, there needs to be confession. And so he goes and he lists many others. And for example, where there's a death penalty involved, the death penalty alone won't do it. Ad shiyasu teshuva v'yisvadu. There needs to be teshuva and there needs to be vidu. So the process of atonement isn't completed until the final stage, and the final stage is vidui. The very last thing we do is vidui, confession. What is this, the role of this confession? If it's not to acknowledge the sin, which it would have been had we been told that this was right at the front, that this was the first thing, that we see it isn't. It isn't so at all. The concept of vidui is something else. It's something that comes right at the end. It completes it. And just as we've said that at the end of the day your mitzvah is attributed to the person who finishes it, because everything before then is a means to the end. The real ultimate is that final stage, that finishing it up. That's what really does it. That's what really completes it. So the whole teshuvah process, which sounds so beautiful, a person acknowledges he's done wrong. He feels regret and remorse for having done wrong. He develops himself into a position where he's so sincere about it that he can't foresee himself doing it again, and he undertakes not to do it again. All that beautiful process is nothing compared to the vidui. to being able to say, I did it, which comes at the very end. So that the pinnacle of the teshuva process is so beautiful in itself. The teshuva process is so pure and so spiritual in itself. The most formal part of it, the most prescribed part of it, the least spontaneous part of it, is vidui dvorim, the formula you have to say, I sinned, I did this, I did that, I did the following. And that, we're told, is the ultimate. That's where it all is at. Everything else is just a means to getting there. There's an interesting Gemara where the Gemara discusses in Kiddushin Daf Mem Tes, what happens if a man stands under the chuppah and he takes a ring in his hand and his bride puts out her forefinger and the rabbi says, say after me, and shows him a siddur, and he says, Hare at mekudeshesli v'taba azu k'das Moshe v'Yisrael, you are sanctified to me, you are to be my wife according to the laws of Israel. Almanas, but there's a condition. The condition is that I'm a tzaddik. That's all. Okay, so let's say the thing goes through. And a few weeks later, the things in the marriage aren't going that well. And now she wants to marry somebody else. And she comes along to see a rabbi. She says, I want to get married again. The rabbi says, but are you divorced from the first guy? She says, I was never married to him. And the rabbi says, excuse me, I was at the wedding. She said, well, then you heard what he said. He said, I'm marrying you on condition that I'm a tzaddik, that I'm righteous. And we all know he isn't a tzaddik. Everybody knows he was a wicked man. So that wedding didn't have any legal effect. It was a conditional wedding, which one can make any condition. He made a condition, and the condition wasn't fulfilled. So we can ignore that. That wasn't a valid wedding at all. Now I want to remarry. I don't need a get. The din is she does need a get. Because we're not so sure that she isn't married. Because maybe he was a tzaddik. But the Gemara uses a strange phrase and says, Afilu Rosha Gomur, even if he's an absolute Rosha, everybody knows that he's murdered and he's stolen and he's cheated and he's eaten on Yom Kippur and he's done all sorts of terrible things. Still, she's going to need a get. Why? Shema hir her tshuva b'da'atu. Maybe just before he said that, he had a flash of tshuva. For a moment he decided to do tshuva. Decided to repent. How are we going to know what went on in his mind? How are we going to know that? Okay, so maybe he decided to repent. Does that make him a tzaddik? Because what was his condition? His condition wasn't, I'm marrying you on condition I'm not a wicked man. He said, I'm marrying you on condition I'm a tzaddik. Now today to be a tzaddik is very easy. Everybody's a tzaddik today. But in the old days, it used to have to do something to become a tzaddik. You had to be somebody to be a tzaddik. And this, the Gemara was written in the old days, where to be a tzaddik required some kind of qualification. And all he does, this wicked man who's murdered and raped and stolen, and we think maybe he stood there for a moment, and he had a moment of teshuva, and that makes him a tzaddik. Seems to be that's a possibility. And that halacha is not so far-fetched, it's actually brought in the Shulchan Aruch. Where all these conditional marriages are listed, one of them is this very one in Even Oezer Simon Lamed Ches. Amenasha ani tzaddik, if he says, I'm marrying you on condition that I'm a tzaddik, afilu rosho gomor, even if he's an absolute total rotter, harezu mekudeshes misofek, we consider her a doubtful case, and therefore we've got to consider that she's married. Shema hirer teshuva belibo, because maybe he did teshuva in his heart at that moment. Now, particularly interesting, and this is a comment of the Chelkes Mechokek, one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, says the following: Afal pi she'anu roim hagzeilo adayin beyodo. What would happen if he stole somebody's Porsche? And we see outside the shul is the Porsche with the ribbons on and everything. They're standing outside the shul, and we say to him, 1 second, you're marrying this woman on condition you're a tzaddik. Whose Porsche is that outside? He says, I stole it. He said, did you pay for it? Have you returned it? No. We're driving, we're going to drive back, we're going to drive to the reception in the Porsche. That's the wedding car, I stole it. Surely we're not going to consider him married? Says the Pechelkes Mechokek, Even though we see the stolen article still in his hand, there's still a possibility there's a tzaddik. You didn't know it was so easy to be a tzaddik, huh? It'll cheer us all up, this. He's not called about tshuva. You can't be about tshuva if you still got the stolen Porsche. That's not possible. So he's not called about tshuva. Ad shiyashli chasheretz miyodo. Back to the same image. Until he drops the reptile. Or the Porsche in this case, that have certain similarities, it would appear. Mikol mokum, kivan shiyiskin bedaatoi lahashiv. Nevertheless, once he's decided in his mind that he's going to give it back, nikra gamken tzaddik. He's also called a tzaddik. At least there's a sofik kiddushin, there's a doubt, it's possible that the marriage takes effect. It's an amazing thing. A man can be a rotter, he can have stolen property in his possession, he can undertake in his mind that I'm going to do tshuva, I'm not going to steal anymore, and I'm going to give back my stolen property, and at that moment he's already called a tzaddik. Not about tshuva, but a tzaddik. See, to be a tzaddik is easier than to be about tshuva. And the world is upside down. Now people first become about tshuva, and then they become tzaddikim. Doesn't take long, but that's the process that they follow. In those days, it was the opposite. To be a tzaddik is easy. To be about tshuva, that's a different story. To be about tshuva, you've got to do all sorts of things. But to be a tzaddik was relatively easy. But how does that fit in with the Rambam? Where the Rambam says, until you've confessed, there's no kapora, there's no atonement. That's something that has to be analyzed. That's something that has to be understood. How can that be? Where the Rambam says, when you do tshuva, chayav lifradish, you've got to do vidui, and all these cases, even if they bring sacrifices, ein miskape lohen bekorbonom ad shiyasu tshuva v'yisvadu vidui dvorim. They've got to do tshuva and verbal confession. Now, verbal confession, that has to be done aloud. So we know whether he's done it or not. He's standing under the chuppah and he's just done an aveira. He's just done something terribly bad. And he says, I'm marrying you on condition that I'm a tzaddik. And we listen and we don't hear any vidu. That's all he says. Not another word. No ashamnu, no bogadnu, no gozalnu, nothing. But in his mind he's decided, I'm not going to steal anymore and I'll give back the stolen property. This is the chelkes machokim. Maybe he's a tzaddik. How can he be a tzaddik if he hasn't done vidu, if he hasn't finished the tshuva process? We just learned in the Medrash that until the mitzvah is finished, it doesn't count. It seems to be nothing until it's finished. It's not attributed to the person who started it. It's not attributed to the person who carries it through. It's only attributed to the person who finishes it, because the finishing touch is what completes the mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah until then. So the mitzvah of teshuva has not been performed by this man who's standing under the chuppah with a Porsche outside. He might, in his mind, he might be doing and thinking and planning all sorts of things, but he hasn't completed the process of teshuva. And therefore the Rambam says there's no kapora, there's no atonement. How did the Gemara say in the Shulchan Aruch Paskins that he might be a tzaddik? So it would appear that there's a difference between being a tzaddik and having kapora. There's a difference between atonement and being a tzaddik. That means that it's feasible that it would emerge, and the Minchas Chinuch seems to learn this way. It seems to be quite feasible that a person has done wrong in the past and has not been atoned for what he did wrong, and yet he can be a tzaddik. It's possible. A person could have murdered, a person could have stolen, a person can have talked lashon hora, a person can have eaten on Yom Kippur, a person can have done all sorts of things, and is not atoned for whatever reason, but that doesn't mean he's not a tzaddik. And that's a new idea for us. That it's possible to separate responsibility for wrongdoings of the past from being a tzaddik. What is the difference, and how do we understand that? Once again, we need to appreciate that there are two aspects to ourselves and two aspects to the things that we do. The one aspect is the action in its own rights. And the other aspect is the action in terms of what its effect on us. And we are judged, not only by God, but by ourselves as well. We are judged on two different levels. What we do, and who we are. And there's usually an assumption, if one thinks about it superficially, that the two are connected. We are, this is the accumulation of what we do and what we experience. But that's not necessarily so. What we are is not necessarily a function of what we do. What we are is a function of how we handle what we do, which is very different from just what we do. Before we look at what we do, let's look at issues that are beyond our control, things that happen to us. How is it that you can have two people who go through the identical experience, one comes out great, one comes out a tzaddik, and one comes out a rosha? And when they go and see their respective psychologists, the psychologist of the wicked man says, well, it's quite clear why you became wicked. Anybody would have become wicked in those circumstances. Look what you went through. Anybody who went through that, you went through the concentration camps, or you went through a terrible experience, or you were let down by your parents, or who knows by what. It's understandable why you've become such a messed up human being. Anybody would do the same. And at that very moment, there's another man who's been through exactly the same experience. And he's sitting with the psychologist, and the psychologist is explaining to him, what a great man you are, and the reason you're so great is because you went through such an experience. And if those two people would get together and share what each psychologist told to them, they would have a bit of a problem. What is it? The answer is, it's not the experience that makes a person great, and it's not the experience that destroys a person. Experiences don't build people, and experiences don't destroy people. That we do ourselves. The question is how we use the various experiences that affect us. Do we use them to build, or do we use them to destroy? So we go through a process, we go through an experience. Sometimes it's a very negative experience. Sometimes it's horrific. Sometimes it's a nightmare. And certain people will come out of that experience strong, reinforced, ennobled. That's what when the Torah talks about the nisyonos. What a nisyon is, when Hashem tries us, when He tests us. And there's so many chazals that point to the fact that the testing us is not just a process of test, let's try and see what happens to you. It's a process of education. Let's turn on the screws a little bit, so that you'll become stronger, so that you'll become reinforced, so that you'll become tempered. And sometimes it's a pleasant experience. We go through a simcha, we go through a joy, we go through a delightful experience. We go through a happy occasion. And that builds us and makes us feel good and uplifts us. And sometimes you'll have exactly the opposite. A person will go through a difficult time, a tragic time, and it will break him. And sometimes he goes through a simcha. He goes through joyous times. And it breaks him and it destroys him. It's not what happens to us. What happens to us is beyond our control. That's one of the ways that we understand this whole old age-old conflict between God's pre-knowledge and our free will. Does God know what's happening to us? If He does, what about our free will? If He doesn't, what about God's omnipotence? One of the ways that it's explained is along these lines. What happens to us is predetermined. There's very little choice we have over what happens to us. Where we find ourselves at a particular time, where we were born, what kind of family background we have, all these things that happen to people during their lifetimes, if you actually analyze them, you find a lot of it is beyond our control. A lot of the really important things are totally beyond our control. What isn't beyond our control is what we do with them. How we emerge from those experiences is totally within our control. Nobody can affect what kind of people we are, what kind of people we become as a result of those experiences. Sometimes they're positive experiences, sometimes they're negative experiences, but it's our choice to decide what impact they have on us, the way we relate to them and the way what we allow them to do to us. If that's the case, then exactly the same applies to the things we do. We do a mitzvah. Does that automatically mean I've become a greater person because I did a mitzvah? No. If we'll take this idea a step further and we'll say the things that happen to me don't automatically impact on me. I choose how they impact on me. The same thing will happen to two people. One will become greater, one will become less great. Then what happens if two people do the same thing? Is it possible that it will affect them both differently? Is it possible that by doing something one person will grow and one person will be destroyed? Sure, it's possible. Got the lovely piece of Vilna Gaon that I've quoted so often, where the Vilna Gaon says, the Torah is compared to water. He says, yes, that's all it is, it's water. And if you pour water on seeds, on flowers or vegetable seeds, you pour water on those seeds, beautiful flowers grow, and beautiful vegetables grow, and a crop can grow from the water. But what happens if you pour water on weeds? Then the weeds grow. The Torah strengthens the raw material that's there already. And if a person's a weed, the more Torah he learns, the better weed he'll become. If a person's wicked, the more Torah he learns, the more wicked he'll become. He'll be a stronger Rosha. there needs to be raw material there to start with. And that's why there are all these conditions as to before one starts learning Torah, that one has to be a bit of a mensch already. You have to be a human being before. That's the whole Derech Eretz Kodma the Torah that we've discussed so often. You've got to be a human being first, because Torah will have positive impact on a mensch. If a person's a human being, the Torah will have positive impact in him. If a person's not a human being, the Torah can have negative impact, chas v'shalom. The Gemara that says that sama chayim lemayminim bo and sama movis lemasmiilim bo. While it's a life potent for people who learn the Torah with their right hand, so to say, it's poison for people who learn it with their left hand. There is the feasibility that the same experience, the same action, although objectively defined as a mitzvah, builds one person while it destroys another person. Because to start off with, the raw material isn't correct, the approach isn't correct, the attitude isn't correct, and it actually becomes destructive. And so when a person does an Avera, there are two things he's got to look at. When a person transgresses, there are two things he's got to look at. The one is, the action was wrong. And sometimes you have to do the action, and it's still wrong. There are times when you need to do tshuva for something you had to do. Still, there needs to be tshuva for it. One of the examples of that we've used previously is the case that when Mordechai, Purim time, when Mordechai became involved in politics and he started saving the nation and the world, he actually lowered his status in Torah. He was a greater man in wisdom before the whole Purim episode than he was at the end of it. And so we said, does that mean what he did was wrong? Does that mean he should have opted rather to sit and learn his Gemara and not save the people? No, of course he had to save the people. Sometimes we have to take a choice to do something which in certain ways has negative impact, in certain ways is perhaps not the best choice that we could make, but circumstances require that we take that particular action. And it requires teshuva. The action is wrong. That doesn't mean I'm no good. That doesn't mean I'm a Rosha necessarily. But the action needs to be repaired. And there's another aspect and another dimension to doing wrong. That is the impact it has on me. What has it done to me? And how do I recover from the downfall? How do I recover from whatever negative effect it's had on me in the process? Those are the two elements that we have to look at. As far as the individual is concerned, it's very interesting. What I am and what I've done are two different things. What I am is determined momentarily and instantaneously. You can have a great human being and in one moment he can become a nobody. He can become a nothing. And you can have a nothing of a human being, and yesh koine olomo b'shoa achas. That person can become great in a moment. Because all you need is a flash of inspiration, a moment of seeing the world in a different way. And at that moment, one's able to change one's whole being, one's whole status. That doesn't mean that you've achieved a great lot. It doesn't mean that you've undone all the negative that you've done. It doesn't mean that you've set in motion a whole lot of positive. Nothing like that at all. You've had no impact at all on the world. But in terms of who you are, you've changed. Change within the human being, within himself, can happen instantaneously, and he can lose it instantaneously. And that's the question of whether or not a person is a tzaddik. Whether or not a person is a tzaddik is irrespective of the actions he's done. The actions he's done might or might not have affected him to make him a tzaddik. But what determines whether he's a tzaddik or not is who he is at that moment. How does he see the world at that moment? That's all that's important. And how does he see his past? How does he see the things he's done? If the thief and the murderer looks at his past and says, I'm proud of it, then he's not a tzaddik. But if the thief and the murderer looks at his past and says, I'm not proud of it, I'm embarrassed about it, then he might well be a tzaddik. If a person looks at his future and he's full of hope and he's full of ideas and he's full of promise, he might be a tzaddik. Whether he's ever going to get to implementing it, who knows? That's not affected by whether or not he's a tzaddik. And so we find ourselves all the time operating on two planes. Who am I and what am I doing? And both of them are equally important. It's necessary to be effective on both levels, on the who am I level and on the what am I doing level. But the question of whether I'm a tzaddik or not is a function of who I am. It's not a question of what I'm doing. And therefore, when a person has done wrong, he can become a tzaddik by a moment, a flash of inspiration. At that moment, he can become a tzaddik. And that's terribly important for us to know at this time of the year. Terribly important for us to know that while we're sitting in shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, irrespective of what's gone before, irrespective of what we've done, That doesn't limit who we are. That's the amazing thing in this understanding. That what we've done in no way limits who we are. It's a terrible thing to come into a Rosh Hashanah and a Yom Kippur and think, I'm limited by what I've done. Mr. Shaw spoke this morning in Shul at the Kiddush about being able to go beyond the limitations that we impose upon ourselves. And to come into Shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and think to ourselves, I am limited. Of course I'm limited. Look what I've done, all the things that I've done. Look at all the opportunities I had that I didn't do. Look what I've missed. Look what I could have been and I'm not. Look what I shouldn't have done and I did do. And one can become so bogged down in all that negative thought. So who am I? The answer is, who am I? That depends on now. Who am I doesn't depend on what I've done. Even if I'm not forgiven for what I've done, that's another issue, it's another question. We'll discuss in a moment how I get forgiven for what I've done. But even if I'm not forgiven for what I've done, that doesn't detract from who I'm capable of being right now. There is no limit to who I'm capable of being right now. It just depends how I look at myself and how I look at the world around me. That determines who I am right now. And there is absolutely no limitation. I can be the Rosh HaGomer, as the Gemara says. That man standing under his chuppah can be a Rosh HaGomer, an absolute wicked, no good so-and-so. And he says, I'm marrying you on condition I'm a tzaddik. And we say, oh my goodness, the rabbi starts scratching his head. Now I've got a problem. Is she or isn't she married? And the Aden, the witnesses standing around, will say, what's your problem? We all know he's a Rosh HaGomer. And the rabbi will have to say, I don't know that he's a Rosh HaGomer. Who knows what's going on in his head? And the people will say, what do you care what's going on in his head? He's murdered, he's stolen, he's raped, look at the car outside, that in itself is stolen. And the rabbi will still have to scratch in his head and say, that's a different issue. What he's done is a different issue. But that doesn't necessarily limit who he is. He's capable of being anybody at this moment. He might be a tzaddik goel, he might be absolutely righteous. We don't know. But that halacha, that law, which is a strange sort of law, to actually find it recorded in the Shulchan Aruch. Is it likely to happen? Has it ever happened? I'm sure it's never happened, and probably never will happen. But it's a principle that it teaches us, that the human being, irrespective of what he's done, is capable, just through the way he's thinking, to transform himself instantaneously from the lowest of the low to the highest of the high. And we have that capacity on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And the way, part of the way God judges us is not only in terms of what we've done, but in terms of who you are. The Rambam says further on, Kol echod ve'echod b'mnei ha'odom yesh lo zechuyos v'avoynes. Every human being has merits and sins. Mi shezechuyos ov yeserus al avoynes ov tzadik. If his merits are greater than his sins, he's a tzadik. If his sins are greater than his merits, he's a Rosh. And if it's 50-50, he's a Beinoni. If it's well balanced, then he's somewhere in the middle. And nations the same. Then he goes on to say, if his sins are more than his merits, and therefore he is a Rosh, miyad hu meis berisho. He dies immediately as a Rosh. So I ask you, why don't the shuls turn into into a morgue on Rosh Hashanah? Look what he says. Anybody who's done more wrong than good dies immediately. And if he's done more good than wrong, then he's immediately written for a good year. But he adds, the shikul zeh einu lefi minyan azechius va'avoinus. This is not determined by numbers, by how many mitzvahs and how many averus, einu lefi gudlom, but by their value. And we don't know their value. But one thing is for sure, if a person can instantaneously become a tzaddik, that has enormous value. That has the capacity to outweigh a lot of wrongdoing when God's doing the weighing up. For a person to change himself so dramatically at that moment, irrespective of what he's done in the past, to become a tzaddik at that moment by the way he perceives himself and the world around him, that's unbelievable. And that's the capacity that the human being has on Rosh Hashanah. But for kapora, for atonement is adjusting the effects of the cause and effect relationships of what is past. The fact is, he stole the Porsche. And he can become whatever tzaddik he wants. there's somebody in the world who doesn't have a Porsche. So it doesn't help becoming a tzaddik. Your stolen property is still there, you have to give it back. And that's why the Gemara and the Rambam paskens that in matters, interpersonal matters, you can't be atoned, you can't get atonement until you've rectified the wrong. That's part of atonement. So there are two aspects to teshuva. One is to improving the effect that the wrongdoing had on me. That I can do very quickly. That I can do in my mind. That I don't have to do anything more about. But there's still something else. The sin has been done. The damage has been done, and until the damage has been repaired, there cannot be atonement. So just as in interpersonal things, if you've stolen something, you have to return it. If you humiliated somebody, you've got to apologize. If you spoke Lashon Hora about somebody, you've got to set it right. All these things, if you told a lie, you've got to go and tell the truth. All these things are necessary in order to rectify what was done wrong. And that's part of Kapora. Also part of Kapora, part of that atonement is Vidui Dvorim. You've got to be able to say it aloud. And let's now briefly understand why Vidui comes at the end of the process. Vidui is not the confession in terms of clarifying that I've done wrong. Of course that you do at the very beginning, but you don't have to do that aloud. That's nobody's business. You don't have to say it to God even. The very first process of tshuva is an internal recognition that I've done wrong, and a decision to try and do something about it and to come right. And one can become a tzaddik by that just going through one's mind. One can become a tzaddik. But at the end of all that, it's necessary to say it out loud. I have stolen. I have told lies. I have done this. I have done that. It's necessary to say it out loud. And that's part of the repair process. That's part of the process of repairing the damage. There are two possible stages to make a confession. The one is soon after you've done the wrong, before the teshuva process, and the other is, as we're learning, at the end of the teshuva process. The difference is in the effect it has on you. If a person steals something, and a moment later he confesses, well, that's very nice. Steals, has regrets, confesses, returns the stolen property. But it's all on one level. There's no big major changes in where he's holding. He stole, and now he's confessed to stealing. But if a person stole, at that time he was a gunner, then he becomes a tzaddik, goes through the whole tshuva process. Now he's not a gunner anymore, now he's a tzaddik. And as a tzaddik he's got to say, I stole. That's so hard. For a gunner to say, I stole, that's something to be proud of. That's professional competence. That's my job. There's nothing difficult for a gunner to say, I stole. There's nothing difficult for a shakran, for a habitual lie teller to say, I told lies. That's nothing wrong with that. There's no rapist to say, I raped. No problem with that. But for a tzaddik to say, I stole. For a tzaddik to say, I raped. For a tzaddik to say, I told lies. That is so painful. That's so hard. That's not the tshuva process. That's the kapora process. That's the atonement process. That's already paying for it when a person does that. And that's what the vidui is for. Vidui is to confront us after we've improved ourselves. Vidui is to confront us after we've become tzaddikim. Okay now, Mr. Tzaddik. You're a tzaddik, that's fine. But look at the damage you did before you became a tzaddik. And it's still the same you. There's got to be something. You've got to repair the damage. So just as if you've stolen something, you have to return the stolen property. And if you lied, you've got to rectify the damage caused by your lying. And if whatever it is, so you also have to fully feel the suffering of wrongdoing. And that's only by you, Mr. Tzaddik, saying, I've stolen, I've lied, I've cheated, and so on. I didn't keep Shabbos properly. I ate without a brocha. That's hard for the tzaddik to say. And so contrary to the way we would have said perhaps an hour ago, that confessing is the first step, and finally you land up at the levels of tshuva, of repenting. What we're saying now is exactly the opposite. First one has to repent, and that's all internally. One does that in one's mind. And that one can get one to enormous heights. By that mental process of repentance, one can become an absolute tzaddik. One can become a righteous person. But once one has become the righteous person, in order to get to the last stage, which is the stage of atonement, where God says, not only do I accept you as a tzaddik, that I did a long time ago already, I accepted you as a tzaddik, but I've even forgiven you for the past. That's only when, as a tzaddik, you've looked at your past and you've been able to say to yourself, Oshamnu, Bogadnu, Gozalnu, I've done wrong, I've been treacherous, I've stolen, and all the other things that we've said. Which explains also why the vidui is put so coldly and formally. Shouldn't have to do that, you know, when the Catholics confess, they don't have a list to check off. They go and they sit next to the little box and they can say whatever they want, just what they did, that's all. They don't come with a whole list. Imagine how wealthy the church would get if every time somebody confessed, they said the kind of list we say on Yom Kippur. All the things that relate to Hashemnu, and with Bogadnu, you've got all the bases and everything that relates to Bogadnu and so on, and then you've got the whole list of our chetz. Just look how much we confess to on Yom Kippur and during the Slichus period. Look how much we confess to. And it's all laid out. We read it off a list, and it's very easy to do it in a formalistic way and say, well, this list was written for all sorts of funny people. There are only one or two that apply to me. And to focus on the one or two doesn't work like that. Because it's so hard to actually confront it. It's so hard to actually look at it and say, I've done it. If it was left to us to formulate our own confession statements, we would each find a few things to confess for. Find 5 things, 6 things, 10 things, 20 things. The real wicked ones among us might find 25 things, 30 things. Can you try and think of 30 things you've done wrong? It's hard to actually list 30 things you've done wrong. But you go through the vidui list, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, it's endless. Just that each one you look at and you say, yeah, this I could fall into this category. And it's necessary that we do that after we've gone through the process. And that's why vidui comes at the end of the slichus. That's why vidui comes right at the end. During Shachris on Yom Kippur, Musaf on Yom Kippur, the vidui comes right at the end. First we go through everything else. And finally, when we've reached that level of the tzaddik gomer, of being able to be accepted by God for what we are as righteous, right at this moment, when a Jew is standing in shul on Rosh Hashanah, he's righteous. That's why he's there. Otherwise he wouldn't be in shul on Rosh Hashanah. And he comes back again the next day, and he's there on Yom Kippur. He's there on Kol Nidre night. He fasts on Yom Kippur. He's there from morning till night. He doesn't move from his place. The whole, of course, he's a tzaddik. Why else would he be there if his perception of the world wasn't that way? It means an enormous amount to the Ribbono Shel Olam that we do that. But having done that, comes the last and the most difficult part of the mitzvah. The mitzvah of vidui, of looking at ourselves and saying, yes, we're tzaddikim, and that's very wonderful, but we also have to repair the damage that we've done. And that we do during the process of the vidui, as we'll do in a short while's time after we've had some tea and we start with the slichus this evening.